Welcome to the Kansas Cyclist Podcast, part of the Kansas Cyclist website and the Eero Podcast Network, podcasts that inform by focusing on the news and the people behind the news. My name is Edward Eero, and together with Randy Reza, webmaster of the Kansas Cyclist, we are your hosts for Episode 7 on July 24th, 2009. In this episode, we will be interviewing Tim and Cindy Travis, who have been biking the world since 2002, and we also have an on-the-scene interview with the Journey of Hope riders in Sedalia, Missouri. The Kansas Cyclist Podcast provides news and information about bicycling in Kansas and neighboring states. The podcast is a feature of the Kansas Cyclist website, which is found at www.kansascyclist.com. Links to the Kansas Cyclist Podcast can be found at the website and at the Eero Podcast Network website on the web at epn.eero.com. In each episode of the Kansas Cyclist Podcast, we will recap news and information about bicycling, talk about upcoming rides, let you in on new trails to try, listen to your feedback, answer your questions, go on the scene for events, provide bicycle safety tips, and interview interesting individuals involved in bicycling here in the heartland of the United States. We welcome your feedback, so please write or send your audio voice file, comments, or suggestions to podcast@kansascyclist.com. Welcome back to Episode 7 of the Kansas Cyclist Podcast. We have a really great show for you today. We also want to thank Action Wipes for being one of our sponsors. Take it from our experience, these wipes are fantastic, as not only are they made for athletes, they are also made of 100% natural ingredients, including pure oils such as tea tree and eucalyptus. So stop using baby wipes, which can and will dry out your skin with all that alcohol, and try Action Wipes. Please go to the Kansas Cyclist website, and you will see the ad with the link to order. All Kansas Cyclist Podcast listeners get 15% off their orders by using the website link or just entering Kansas on their orders. Okay, our first area, as always, is news and information. Randy, there's a lot that you have on the Kansas website. Tell us some highlights.
First off, the Tour of Missouri recently survived a scare when Missouri Governor Jay Nixon threatened to freeze funds for the race due to a state budget squeeze. The Missouri Division of Tourism had set aside $1.5 million, and if the monies had been frozen, that would have resulted in the cancellation of this year's event, which was scheduled for the week of September 7th through 13th. Thankfully, after supporters of the tour inundated the governor's office with calls and emails, Nixon relented and released the funds for the race. Canceling the tour at this late date would have potentially been disastrous for the state and left them open to lawsuits that would have cost far more than the $1.5 million to defend, not to mention the loss of income from the tour participants and fans. It's good to see that Missouri eventually did the right thing. Not sure what this means for coming years, but it's hard to imagine that it's a particularly good sign.
Yes, and the funding was for 3 years, and this is the third year, so I guess it does leave in jeopardy whether the state will come back and provide additional funding. I know there was efforts to provide private funding, so I do hope they're successful. I mean, this thing has really been a nice race for, you know, all of Missouri, and especially in St. Louis and Kansas City, and now this year with the race ending here, it should cause even more excitement.
Yeah, there's been so much excitement among cycling fans in the area. It would be a great loss.
And now, you know, with the Tour of France, too, having created all the excitement about bicycling, especially now things in high def, having the website with live feeds, and, you know, Lance Armstrong yesterday announcing his new team, which is the Radio Shack team. That's just created a lot of excitement about cycling in the U.S. So I do hope that the tour will be back next year.
All right, moving on. In Topeka, Mayor Bill Bunton says he supports the concept of more bicycling in his city, but he vetoed spending $15,000 to develop a Topeka bikeway master plan, and he labeled it an unnecessary expenditure. In response, a group called Complete Streets of Topeka has started a grassroots campaign to raise money for the plan, and they're asking for $5 donations. If you're not familiar with the term, complete streets refers to the concept of designing all roadways so they're safe and welcoming to all users, regardless of whether they get around by car, bike, or foot. In the past, we've built far too many roads with only one thought in mind, moving as many cars as possible as fast as possible. And in the process, we've developed a road system that discourages active transportation. Complete Streets is really a simple and common sense approach to road design, and one that should be embraced going forward. It's encouraging to see Topeka consider the idea, but it's a shame they're not willing to take even a tiny step in the right direction.
Yeah, it'd be nice to get some funding.
From Jefferson County, Colorado, comes news of a major threat to bicyclists in that state. County commissioners there are asking the state legislature to draft a law that would allow counties to ban bicyclists from county roads. The state law already gives cities that authority, but the law is unclear when it comes to counties. If the proposed legislation goes through, this would put a huge number of routes at risk. So Bicycle Colorado, which is the statewide bicycling advocacy organization, is putting together a campaign to fight the dangerous proposal.
Plus, it sets up a bad precedent for other counties if they are successful.
Yeah, I mean, it would really be awful. There was something similar going on in Iowa earlier this year, but it was related mostly to cycling events. This would ban all bicyclists from the road, so it is really dangerous.
Yeah. Well, to keep up with the latest bicycling news from Kansas and neighboring states, please go to the Kansas Cyclist website and subscribe to the feed, and you'll see all kinds of news and information there. And if you have an RSS feed reader, or you can sign up by email, so do go over there. And remember also that the Kansas Cyclist is on Twitter. It's twitter.com/KansasCyclist, one word. Our next section is the upcoming rides, and Randy has a number of them detailed on the website. What do you have for us of interest this week?
Okay, hitting a few highlights. On July 25th, we had the Flint Hills Death Ride, which is billed as one of the most challenging one-day mountain biking events in the country, with about 70 miles on the gravel and dirt roads in the area around Madison, Kansas. And there's supposed to be about 5,000 feet of climbing in this 70 miles.
Now, are you doing this one?
I'm not doing this one. I did a gravel ride last weekend, which was 100 miles.
Yeah.
It was pretty tough.
Yeah, congrats, because that was your first century on gravel, right?
Yes, my first dirty century.
Yeah, congrats.
Thanks. And each year, Dodge City, Kansas has a community celebration they call Dodge City Days, which includes a group bike ride. This year, the ride is on August 1st with up to 41 miles of riding, and they also have events like a rodeo, a parade, a barbecue contest, a craft fair, and many more activities. August 2nd is the annual Cider Mill Century, which is put on by the Johnson County Bike Club. This ride starts and ends at the Lewisburg Cider Mill and takes a back roads route through Miami County, Kansas, visiting the communities of Hillsdale, Paola, Osawatomie, and Lacine, with mileage options from 25 to 100 miles. I've done this ride in the past 2 years and will probably do it again, although I'm considering taking an alternate route this year and mixing in some gravel with the paved sections. You doing the ride this year, Ed?
Yeah, I this is a ride that I've done in past years. Last year I could not because I was sick, but I've did it, I think, 3 years before that. The only thing is it's always so hot. I just wish, even with the name of the ride, you think of cider mills in the fall. It would be nice if we had some cooler weather. But hopefully maybe we'll luck out this year, because it seems like every year it is just ghastly hot. I mean, 90s and high humidity and winds. So it would be nice to get a century ride in.
Yeah, both years I've done it, it's been burners.
Yeah. But the JCBC does a great job with the sags, plenty of water. So if you're in the area, it is a good one to do.
And on hot days is when you really need the sags, and they do a great job.
Mm-hmm.
Elsewhere in the region, we have the Copper Triangle ride in Colorado on August 1st, and the Colorado Rocky Mountain Bike Tour on August 2nd through 8th, the Rolling to the River Century Ride in Blair, Nebraska on the 8th, and the Colorado Peace Ride in Southwest Colorado on the 9th.
Remember, for a complete listing of all rides and races, visit the events section of the Kansas Cyclists website. There you will have all the details about it and even ways to sign up for the event. So do take a look at the website. Our next section is new trails to try, and Randy, I know, is always out looking for new trails and does appreciate if you would send in information to him if it's not covered on the website. So what do you have this week?
Well, I haven't ridden any new trails myself lately, but I'll pass along my impressions of the Lawrence River trails in Lawrence, Kansas. Though I haven't been there for probably a year or so, these are actually some of the best trails I've ridden. They're located on the north side of the Kansas River and run through the woods parallel to the river for several miles. The trails were built and are maintained by the Lawrence Mountain Bike Club, and I think it's a fantastic trail, particularly for beginner or intermediate mountain bikers. The trails are largely smooth and flowy, without a lot of rocks or roots or tight turns. That's not to say they're not challenging. I think one of the really neat things about this trail is that it's as challenging as you want to make it. If you take it slow and you take it easy, it should be manageable even by novice cyclists. But if you take it just a bit faster, the intensity ramps up and you really need to concentrate to find the right line. In addition, there are a few log piles and other obstacles mixed in, which you can choose to either ride through or ride around as your skill level and confidence dictates. The trail is set up as an out and back loop, so you can't easily get lost, and it's relatively short at about 9 miles total. But be aware that the trail is directional, and there are signs along the way to remind you. So you don't want to take it the wrong way and crash head on into someone going the correct direction. There are also walkers and trail runners who use this, so just be aware and don't take blind turns too fast. It's a popular trail with easy access from the nearby University of Kansas campus. It's lots of fun and highly recommended. Just describing it makes me want to go back and hit it again.
Yeah, it does sound like fun.
It is. You need to try it.
Remember, too, to visit the website, because Randy has just about every trail on the Kansas Cyclist website. A new section that we have now is called Bicycle Safety Tips. And this is a new feature of our podcast. And for the next several, we are taking information from bicyclesafe.com and going over their tips on how not to get hit by cars. And so this is primarily for road bikers. The first tip that we're going to talk about today is called the right cross. And what the right cross is the most common way to get hit or almost hit. A car is pulling out of a side street. You're going straight down from a side street, a parking lot, or a driveway from your right. And there are two possible kinds of collisions here. Either you're in front of the car and the car hits you, or the car pulls out in front of you and you slam into it. So the ways to avoid this collision are fourfold, and Randy and I will talk about each one. The first one they recommend is get a headlight. So if you're riding at night, you should absolutely use a front headlight. And in a lot of places, it's required by law. And even for daytime riding, they suggest that having a bright light or some type of flashing light can make you more visible to motorists who might otherwise right cross you. So look for the new LED headlights, which last 10 times longer on a set of batteries than the old style lights. And of course, helmet or head mounted lights are best because they can look directly at the driver to make sure they see your light.
Their second recommendation is to get a loud horn and use it whenever you see a car approaching or waiting ahead of you and to the right. If you don't have a horn, then yell, "Hey," and you may feel awkward or honking or yelling, but it's better to be embarrassed than to get hit. Incidentally, many countries require bells on bicycles, but the U.S. doesn't. And I don't know how many people actually use horns. I don't know of any, but I know they are available.
Yeah, I think just getting the driver's attention, and that the third point is slow down. So if you can't make eye contact with the driver, because this happened to me the other night on a ride where the driver, I was approaching and I was going fairly fast because it was downhill, and he was looking to his right, so he wasn't looking at me. So slowing down and trying to get that contact so that if you're not able to completely stop, you can at least slow down. And sure, that's inconvenient, but again, that beats getting hit. And what I did is also, you know, try to wave or get the driver's attention when he did turn, because, you know, you're traveling pretty fast in my case.
Their fourth suggestion regards lane positioning. You're probably used to riding very close to the curb because you're worried about being hit from behind. But take a look at the car. When that driver is looking down the road for traffic, he's not looking in the bike lane or the area closest to the curb. He's looking in the middle of the lane for other cars. The farther left you are, the more likely the driver will see you. There's an added bonus here. If the motorist doesn't see you and starts pulling out, you may be able to go even farther left, or may be able to speed up and get out of the way before impact, or roll under their hood as they slam on their brakes. In short, it gives you some options, because if you stay all the way to the right and they pull out, your only option may be to run right into the driver's side door. Of course, there's a trade-off. Riding to the far left makes you invisible to the motorists ahead of you at intersections, but riding to the left makes you more vulnerable to the cars behind you. Your actual lane position may vary depending on how wide the street is, how many cars are there, how fast and how close they pass you, and how far you are from the next intersection. On fast roadways with few cross streets, you'll ride farther to the right, and on slow roads with many cross streets, you'll ride farther left. Always be aware of traffic behind you when moving further left.
And they have, if you go to the bicyclesafe.com website, they actually have some diagrams that help explain some of these points. So our next podcast, we will be discussing their second tip on how not to get hit by cars, called the Door Prize. And again, that's at bicyclesafe.com. In this episode, as part of our On the Scene section, I caught up with the Journey of Hope ride, which is part of Push America and the Pi Kappa Phi fraternity in Sedalia, Missouri, on July 21st. They had just rode from Olathe, Kansas, on a cloudy and rainy day after spending time at the Kansas School for the Deaf. Randy was on vacation and could not be part of the interview. Interestingly enough, Randy and I first met 2 years ago in July 2007 when we rode with the Journey of Hope team from Olathe to Stillwell, Kansas, with fellow Johnson County Bike Club member Dale Crawford, who we interviewed in Episode 2 of the podcast. The Journey of Hope started in 1987 with one man's dream of riding his bike across the country. The very next year, his ride inspired Push America, which had been involved in programs for people with disabilities since 1977, to create the largest fraternal fundraising and awareness event of its kind called the Journey of Hope. Today, the Journey of Hope covers 32 different states, cycling over 12,000 miles combined, and is solely comprised of members of Pi Kappa Phi who begin their journey in either San Francisco, California, or Seattle, Washington, with all three teams ending together in Washington, D.C. After riding an average of 75 miles a day, the team members meet with local groups that support people with disabilities, which could include participating in a game of wheelchair basketball or performing puppet shows to educate children on the abilities of people with disabilities. The Journey of Hope reaches out to people through newspapers, radio and television, civic groups, and community leaders, bringing to the forefront the abilities of people with disabilities. From the inaugural team of 21 team members raising $20,000, the team since has been expanded into three different routes of 35 Pi Kappa Phis each, and annually raises more than $500,000. To date, over 900 undergraduate Pi Kappa Phi fraternity members have participated in the Journey of Hope. Okay, I'm here on the scene with Terry Horstman, who is part of the support crew and hails from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and is a junior at...
Will be a senior
at Oregon State. And Mike Keough, who is from Weymouth, Massachusetts, and just a recent graduate from the University of Massachusetts. We're here in Sedalia. The team's just rode from Olathe, Kansas, to Sedalia, and we've caught up with the team here on the scene. Mike, how was the ride from Olathe today?
Yeah, it was pretty good. Hit a little bit of rain to start with this morning. It wasn't really too bad. It never came down all that hard. The group that I was riding with, it got us amped up. It really got us going this morning. Kind of a change of scene for us. The sceneries were really great along the way too. Not too many hills today as well, so pretty easy on the legs. I think about 93 miles in all.
That's still a good clip. Now, the average, when I looked on the website, was about 75 miles, so would this be considered a longer day?
Yeah, this is definitely one of our longer days, and the longest on the trip this summer was about 128 miles.
And where was that?
That was going into Wheatland, Wyoming.
I see. Well, I'm glad it's with the rain and clouds, it's also a little cooler, too, so I'm sure that's been a relief for you. You all pushed off from Seattle, Washington on June 10th. What has been the hardest part so far?
I think one of the more physically demanding days we had was in going into Bozeman, Montana. That was a day we did about 105 miles. We started the day with this fantastic tailwind. We were cruising about 25 miles an hour the whole way. And then we took a left-hand turn, and the tailwind suddenly became a side wind and was blowing us into the road. So we went from about 25 miles an hour to 8 miles an hour, pumping our hardest. It was really only about 10 miles on that portion of the road, but it felt like the longest 10 miles of the whole summer so far. But all in all, a really rewarding day. I'd say that despite the wind, that was probably the day with the best scenery on the trip, too.
Now, generally going west to east, the prevailing winds usually are behind you, but that's not always the case, right?
That's not always the case. Kansas proved to be a big exception. It seemed no matter which way we turned, we always had a headwind.
Well, that's both Randy and I live in Kansas, and that's absolutely right. It's always windy in Kansas, and you never know which way. I've been on rides where you ride out against the wind, then it shifts on you, ride back, and you're trying to do a century ride. Terry, tell us a little bit about, have there been any major maintenance problems with the bicycles so far?
Not anything too bad. We've had a couple bikes that have sustained a bit amount of damage, but bike shops in the area are always, really helpful. And when we tell them what we're doing, they always really want to help and will give us great discounts and stuff like that. And other than that, it's mainly just flat tires on the road, and some days there's more than others. I think one group had about 4 in a span of 10 miles today, so that's always tough to deal with, but these guys have just become pros at fixing flat tires at this point in the trip.
Now each rider brings their own bike, is that correct? And then how do you maintain
the different types of bikes, especially with the, you know, the different parts that would be needed for the different variety that you have?
Well, Mike can probably talk about that a little bit better than I can, but we make a bike shop run just about any town that has a bike shop, and sometimes there's not one in the local area when we're in the smaller towns, but these guys are pros, like I said, at knowing their bicycle and knowing what's wrong with it and how to deal with it. So just they spend so much of our downtime just cleaning the bike, making sure it's in perfect condition to ride the next day, and they've been running really well so far.
And Mike, do you bring extra parts? Do the riders bring some extra tires and stuff for your individual bike?
Yeah, we carry some of that on the road with us each day. We carry some extra tubes in case we get a flat tire, some tire levers and things like that, just to make sure that we're able to change them on the road. Other than that, we keep some spare parts in the vans that follow us along each day. So I've got a spare set of tires in case I ever blow out or anything like that along the way.
Yeah, and that's a good segue then to the SAG vans. There's five vans that you have following the teams, and each of the teams from the website was up to 35, and you have 27, is I think what you said. Tell us about how many members are in, with the support crew, how many guys, and what all is carried in the vans.
Well, we have six guys on our support crew, and pretty much apart from the tubes and the water bottles that the cyclists have on their bikes, we have everything in those vans. All the duffels and backpacks and supplies and food, everything's in the vans. And we set up kind of a leapfrog system on the road so that the vans keep jumping up ahead of each other in 10-mile increments along the route, so that cyclists are always within 5 miles of a support van in case of there being an emergency.
And then does one van stay back as the sweep van, too?
Well, the back van will change based on where the cyclists are and at what point in the leapfrog it is. There is one van that's driven by a project manager who goes up ahead into the town that we'll be staying in, and he gets on pace with everyone that's providing our lodging and our meals for the night and make sure that by the time we get here, we're all ready to go and know where everything's at.
Tell us a little bit about the accommodations that you stay at. I know Randy and I rode with you all 2 years ago, and we picked you up at the School for the Deaf and rode to Stillwell. I think you were coming straight here to Sedalia 2 years ago, too. And in that place, you did have beds and accommodations at the School for Deaf. Tell us about the stops. How are those arranged, and how do they vary? Do you camp out at all?
We haven't done any camping. Mostly we hang out in like school gyms that are closed for the summer. So a lot of that, maybe some parish centers at churches, we stayed at a few of those. And every once in a while, maybe about once a week or so, we're pretty fortunate and are able to get a bed like we did at the Kansas School for the Deaf.
That must be nice to stretch a little bit rather than hard floor. Are the locations picked out in advance then, so you know?
Yeah, we have a great staff that is working in the national office in Charlotte right now that probably has all the details of the next five trips planned right now. So they work just endless hours figuring that out so that when it comes time for us to go on the journey, we know where we're headed, what to expect, who we'll be dealing with, and what town. So there's a lot of specifics that it takes a lot of time to prepare for, but our national staff does a great job doing that.
What would happen if you, let's say there was, you know, a terrible, terrible thunderstorm and you can't be out on the road and you can't make it to the next destination? What do you do?
Well, if there's lightning, we rack the team, like put all the bikes on the van racks and put them all in the cars and drive them up to lodging right away. We want the guys to be able to ride every mile, but safety is the number one priority. So in the event of a thunderstorm or any other bad weather like that, we just take the safe way, put them in vans, get them to lodging safely, and go from there.
Great. Yeah, safety has to be the number one concern. Has there been anybody crashed so far on the trip?
Yeah, we've had two crashes. One guy who's pretty fortunate was able to recover quickly, and he's back on the bike now. We had another guy go down a couple weeks ago, both because of just rubbing tires. And he broke his collarbone and his scapula. So he's back at home, and we're really hoping that he's able to join us before the end of the trip again.
And so was that in the mountain stage? Or?
No, this is actually about a week ago, in I think either in the beginning stages of Kansas or at the end of Colorado.
So simply just rubbing tires here, right, close together. Do you tend to stay in groups, or you have some that sort of hammer out and others that hang behind?
No, actually, this team's been really good. Teamwork is definitely something that the group is very fortunate to have a lot of. We have a lot of strong riders in the group, some riders like myself who've never been on a bike really before this trip, other than about age 10. One thing that the group has been really good about is mixing up the good riders with the less experienced riders every day. So we generally stay in groups of between 2 and 6 people at any given point. But those stronger riders are always pulling some of the more novice riders like myself along every day. That's one thing that I have to say that I'm really proud to be a member of the team. When we're on some stretch of road and in the next mile and a half, you can see 6 pace lines of guys riding pretty close within about, you know, a quarter mile of each other. That to me says that we're really working hard to work as a team.
Well, that tell us a little bit. You say you're not an experienced cyclist, and that was going to be my next question, is what is the criteria for picking team members, and is physical ability one of them, and how much of that is related to long distance cycling, and do you do any, you know, it's a long question here, but advanced training so that, you know, we know that you can make it? So I think, Mike, you're a perfect one to answer that, because you said you hadn't really biked that much.
Yeah, absolutely. The selection process for the next year's team is actually already ongoing for 2010. I knew I was going to be on the team last October, and there is a pretty, it's a kind of long and extensive selection process to be on the team. There's a lot of people who really like to participate in this event. I need to demonstrate an ability to train for the event as well as fundraise. Each cyclist is responsible for fundraising $5,000 to participate. So part of that application process includes writing an essay about what you have planned for training, who you're planning on riding with, how you're planning on developing those skills. It's not so much the national office that Terry was talking about. I think their greatest concern isn't recruiting a group of 21 excellent cyclists. It's recruiting a group of 21 people who are committed to the cause of Push America and are willing to devote themselves to becoming better cyclists in the process. So for me, you know, as being from Massachusetts, I wasn't able to get out on the bike until about April because we had snow all winter. So I had about 2 months on the bike before I got here. It's not as many miles as I would have liked to have under my belt before I got here, but again, I've learned a lot from riding with some pretty strong riders here, and you know, I feel like I'm a much better cyclist now than I was when I started.
You must have been in good shape, though. You must have been working out. You just can't all of a sudden ride across the United States, even for a good cyclist.
Absolutely. There's definite training involved. A lot of cross training in the winter, running and swimming is really what I kind of hammered out at to try and get my cardiovascular up and ready to go for the summer.
Is there a specific, when the team gets together, in this case in Seattle, is there some time that you spend together before, how much time, I guess, would be spent before you left on June 10th?
The crew had a week-long orientation together before the cyclists arrived in Seattle, and then after the cyclists got in town, I think it was another 3 or 4 days of us going through policies and procedures and also getting to know each other and really getting accommodated and comfortable with the guys that you'll be spending every moment of the next couple of months together. So there was a few days in Seattle when we were all together, and then on June 10th we took off for our first day on the road and went to Skycomish, Washington, and then it just became pretty much routine. We'd only known each other for about a week, but when you're with the same guys 24/7, you become pretty close-knit really quickly.
the good thing is the commonality that you have is Pi Kappa Phi fraternity, so that you're all brothers, and so you have some commonality there.
Absolutely. It's been really nice to meet guys who are part of the same organization across the country, too, and just hear how they operate their machine on their campus and trade ideas. It's a great cycling event, and it's definitely something that I think we can all look forward to, that exchange of ideas too, that we can all bring back to our campuses when we get back to school as well too.
How many guys are accepted? So there's 35 per team. So there's obviously some people that want to do it that are turned away. Do they apply again the next year, or do you have some guys like that that have tried over and over?
Well, I don't know the overall numbers of people that apply, but if you're turned down one year, you're more than welcome to apply the next year. And they put all the teams together, not based on the best cyclists, but based on the teams that they feel will best be able to change the way that society views people with disabilities and fraternities. So if you get turned away, you know, it's a pretty elite group of guys, so it's no shame in not being accepted your first time. So people are welcomed and encouraged to try again in the future.
And there's an alumni, too. I know when I rode and met you guys 2 years ago, there was some cyclists from Kansas that were brothers that had been on previous rides that also rode for a certain segment and rode together and had their old shirts on, too. So that must be a fraternity within a fraternity.
Yeah, it kind of is. I think we actually had two guys today who rode along with us. But at the end of the summer, within Pi Kappa Phi, we'll have all earned the distinction of Pi Alpha, and that just means that we're someone who's participated in one of Push America's summer events, either their Journey of Hope, their other cycling event, Gear Up Florida, another project called Build America. It's a team of about 21 guys who travels across the U.S., improving the infrastructure at things like Easter Seals camps for people with disabilities.
How much has your individual team raised then for Push America?
I don't know the overall number. I know we have a few guys on the team, that raised the most overall between the three teams, and another couple that were in the top five. So it's definitely well over 100,000, and probably, if I throw a guess, I'd say over 150, but I'm not exactly sure for a certain number, because we're allowed to continue to raise more over the summer, so it keeps going up and up.
Yeah, I remember when I was looking at it 2 years ago, you all have individual websites so people can go to those and still contribute. What is the general website for our listeners to get to learn more about the ride?
Sure, if you go to pushamerica.org, and under that there's a caption that says events, and from there you can go to the Journey of Hope. There'll be a sidebar there, I think, on your left, and under that you can see the 2009 profiles for all the riders. So if you want to check any of us out, we'd be the ones that says Transamerica next to our name.
Good. Well, anything else, guys, that you'd like to say for our listeners about the Journey of Hope, Push America, or Pi Kappa Phi?
Just got to thank our main sponsors, KRG Capital and Cliff Bar. If it wasn't for them, we wouldn't be able to do this. So just got to give them thanks, and, yeah, can't do it without you guys, so thank you.
Get a lot of Cliff Bars too. That's I'm a big supporter. I love Cliff Bars. In fact, I just had one today for lunch, and I didn't know that they were a sponsor. Well, guys, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the podcast. And take care, and really cycle safe on your journey to Washington D.C. Arriving August 15th. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We were supposed to have an interview with Reed Freeman, a fellow cyclist from the Kansas City area that is doing the Ragbri ride this week in Iowa. But after several calls to his cell phone, all we got was his voicemail, unfortunately. We suspect that his battery is dead and he can't get it recharged. Reed, we hope you're having a great ride, and perhaps we can get a report on Ragbri in the next episode. We are pleased to announce that we have developed a new sponsorship relationship with VeloCal, which is a slick web-based bicycle calendar that any group can use to coordinate their bicycle rides. VeloCal is based in Fort Collins, Colorado, and it is free, so give it a try, especially if you've struggled with the limitations of other web-based group calendars. This one is built for and by cyclists. I first became aware of the VeloCal program when riding in Jefferson City, Missouri with the Jefferson City Riders, and am now using it for the ride I organize here in Overland Park, Kansas on Saturday mornings called the Quivira Park Bike Ride. What I also like about it is that when I have to change the ride, such as 2 weekends ago because of rain on Saturday morning, the service will send out a new email to all subscribed riders of that change. It is a great program, so please click on the link on the Kansas Cyclist website. If any of our listeners are interested in becoming a sponsor of the Kansas Cyclist podcast, please write to podcast@kansascyclist.com, as we would be very pleased to speak with you about the support for our program. Our listenership is growing rapidly. Today we are interviewing Tim and Cindy Travis, an ordinary American couple who decided to live out their dreams by saving their money, quitting their jobs, selling all their possessions, and then setting off to travel around the world by bicycle. They left their home in Arizona in March 2002 and have been on the road ever since with no plans to stop. They have a website at www.downtheroad.org, which includes an ongoing travel blog, short videos, and a photo journal. They update their website regularly from each of their locations and have now added both a Facebook page and a Twitter feed. Cindy Travis was born in New Britain, Connecticut, and grew up on the East Coast. Cindy attended North Arizona University in Flagstaff, Arizona, and received a Bachelor of Science in Geology in 1984. She is a professional geologist, and her most recent employment was with Southwest Groundwater Consultants, Incorporated in Prescott, Arizona, where she worked on water development, sanitation, and environmental cleanup projects. Tim Travis was born in Bloomington, Indiana, and grew up in a small town just north of Indianapolis, Indiana. Tim attended Indiana University in Bloomington and received a Bachelor of Science in Physical Education in 1991. He later attended Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff and earned a Master's of Education in 2001. Tim was a special education teacher, and his most recent employment was in a residential treatment school for girls aged 12 to 18 with severe behavioral and emotional disabilities. Tim and Cindy met in Flagstaff, Arizona, and their first date was a mountain bike ride up Mount Eldon in Flagstaff. Tim took Cindy on her first bike tour 6 months later in the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, and Cindy then was hooked on bike touring. 5 years later, they got married in Las Vegas, Nevada, on bicycles in the Tunnel of Love. They honeymooned on their tandem bike for 3 weeks in northwestern Washington. Tim had always dreamed of going on a world bicycle tour and began planning that trip soon after their honeymoon. After many years of saving and planning, the Travises sold everything and rented out their house in Prescott. On March 30, 2002, they rolled out the door and down the road. Their savings were originally structured to carry them through 7 years of bicycle touring, with a loose plan to spend a year in each of the following continents: North America, South America, Africa, Europe, Asia, and Australia. They started their web page to keep family and friends informed of their location and activities. It has since grown into a photo journal, travel log, and daily written journal. With this income, and the income from their two books, The Road That Has No End and Down the Road in South America, has allowed them to travel for as long as their bodies can hold out. Their goal is to continue their travels for the next 20-plus years. We caught up with Tim and Cindy on Sunday, July 12th, while they were resting with friends in Omaha, Nebraska, before joining the Ragbri Ride Across Iowa on July 19th. Welcome, Tim and Cindy. We are very pleased and honored that you are taking the time from one of your rest days to be with us on the podcast.
Oh, thanks. It's real fun for us.
Hi.
You began your journey in March 2002 from Arizona and then went into Mexico. Did you think then that you'd still be touring on your bikes in July 2009?
When we left, we had a 7-year plan, so we actually thought we'd be quitting about now. But things came up. We wrote a couple books and made a business on the way, so we continued. So we actually thought we'd be done by now.
Well, tell us a little bit about your two books. The first one is The Road That Has No End, and the next one was Down the Road in South America. Have the royalties from those helped keep you on the road?
That's a definite yes. The first book we wrote in 2004, we published in 2004, and it took us a while to get the second book out, which we just finished publishing last summer, July of 2008. And they definitely keep us on the road, along with some internet advertising and commission sales.
Do you have another book planned?
Yeah, we've got a third book we're working on that's about Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam.
Any idea on when it'll be out?
Oh, we've learned one thing on the road is never to give a due date because things always change.
Yeah, that must be nice not having to be into dates and reading your website. I saw that when you were going to New Zealand. Well, I think we'll spend 9 months here, so that's wonderful.
And then 9 months came with how long of a visa we could get. Uh-huh. We'd have stayed longer if they give us a longer visa.
You have traveled in North America, Central America, South America, Asia, China, Australia, New Zealand, Alaska, and Canada. Briefly, what has been the chronology and why did you pick these areas of the world?
Well, we started in Arizona, and the first year we went to Central America, and we went that way just because we didn't want to fly when we initially left. We just wanted to leave from our front door, which was a good decision because it's enough work to get things together to go. To add flying on top of that would have just been harder. Mm-hmm. After that, the second year we went from Quito, Ecuador, down through Chile and Argentina, and then we came home briefly to self-publish our first book, Down the Road That Has No End. And then we flew to Bangkok, Thailand, and started a two-year trip of Asia that included Thailand, Cambodia, about 4 months in Vietnam, and 9 months in China, and then down to Singapore, and then a year in Australia, like we said, 8 months in New Zealand. And then last summer, about a year ago, we started from Valdez, Alaska, and came down all the way back to Arizona, and then up through Utah and due east through Kansas, and now we're in Missouri and Omaha.
Mm-hmm. That trip then started in Alaska, your current trip.
Yeah, the current trip started a bit more than a year ago in Alaska, Valdez, Alaska.
Tim put a lot of time before the trip. He put a lot of time into planning our trip around the weather. And I have to say that that kind of guides us because we want to be in the northern latitudes in the summer and in the central latitudes where the wet and dry seasons are. We want to be there during the dry season. So that also played a part into where we were when.
So how often then between trips have you had breaks and how long have those breaks been?
Well, we've learned that our pace and pattern on the road, we've learned that about every 18 months, we like to take 2 or 3 months off. And that's when we write a lot of the books and work on the website a lot. So our last break was in Yuma, Arizona during the winter. And the next break will be with my family this winter in Indiana.
I see. So the current trip you're heading from here then across Iowa, then into going to Indiana? Is that where the...
Well, we're going across to Iowa, and then we're going all the way to New York, where we're speaking at several colleges there and universities in New York City, and then down through D.C. We have other events there, and then back across to Kentucky to see my uncle, Uncle Kurt. Hi, Uncle Kurt. And then we're going to come north to my parents' house in Greenwood, Indiana, just south of Indianapolis.
Yeah, wow. Tell us how you've handled the times when you've been sick or injured, and have you arranged for health insurance, or has that just been so difficult to obtain insurance that would cover you throughout the world?
When we first left, we didn't have insurance because to continue our COBRA insurance was extremely expensive, and we've left the country right away, so we decided to rely on the health care systems of other countries. And it's actually a lot cheaper to do things in Mexico, Central America, for example, we have had problems with bacteria, and we've bought ciprofloxacin in Mexico without a prescription at a tenth of the price of what it costs here. But as we continued to travel, I really was concerned about health insurance, and so we ended up getting traveler's insurance that covers us when we're outside the United States. So for quite a few years, we had that insurance, but once we came back to the States, we had to switch to another insurance. It's pretty complicated. It's probably one of our biggest expenses is health, our monthly premium for our health insurance.
Yeah, I can imagine it's difficult for, you know, just folks living in the U.S. To have health insurance, even if they're employed sometimes. Have you been, I know from listening to the book, there's been times that you've been sick, sick or injured where it's stopped you for, you know, quite a while on the trip?
Yes. Our biggest ailments to begin with were bacteria ailments where we would just have to stay and get over it, possibly get an antibiotic. Tim crashed once when we were in Peru and really, really cut into his knee pretty bad. And we had to lay up for that for about a week. And overall, it took over a month for the whole the wound to heal. And the other thing we've had to deal with is Giardia in China. Tim picked up a parasite somewhere, we think Vietnam, and it took us years to figure out what was wrong with him. That was the hardest. I mean, I watched him suffer. I could tell something was wrong, but we couldn't pinpoint it. And when you're traveling, you don't have your own doctor. Mm-hmm. And so going to a doctor in a foreign country, it's really quite different. They know you're going to be moving on. And the first doctor didn't diagnose it. The second doctor did. And then it took a while to get the proper medication. So I'd say some of the toughest things on the road has been the health problems.
Medically related. It's almost like you're going to an emergency department time after time. You know, just
always.
Yeah.
And then last summer when we were coming down, we were in the middle of the Yukon in Canada, and I got shingles. And that was really hard to deal with. That really slowed us down because I got into a clinic, got the medication, but the pain associated with shingles just slowed us down for months.
Well, tell us a little bit about your website, downtheroad.org. Has that been up since the beginning of your traveling?
Yeah, I put the website up a few months before we left, and I was getting like three people a day to it. And this is the kind of early-ish days of the internet. And little by little, it grew. We made it first so our family could find us. And this is before any kind of blogging software or anything like that. I'm doing it in HTML. And then it just started snowballing after the second year. And it went through periods of really big growth. And we've outgrown a few servers. And I haven't counted in a while. I think there's 6,000 or 7,000 pages. There's 25,000, 30,000 pictures. And there's 7 years worth of work on that website.
What kind of traffic do you get on that site?
Anywhere, it's seasonal, anywhere between 100 and 130,000 unique visitors a month.
That's impressive.
Wow.
Well, that didn't happen overnight, not at all. I mean, we've studied it, we've researched it, and we work on it, and it's kind of grown on its own now.
You've recently started using Twitter as well. How has that worked out for you?
Oh, I really love it. I like the real-time part of it. People know where we're at. We started Twitter maybe a month ago, and when we were in Pueblo, Colorado, we got a Twitter from the Channel 5 News and asked us if we were still in town for an interview, and we were. So Twitter is just a quick way to get in touch with people, let people know where you're at. I really enjoy it.
And you're actually using that as sort of a microblogging tool now as well, aren't you?
We haven't totally figured out what direction we're going to take with Twitter since it's so new with us and we don't fully understand the whole sociology around the thing. But right now, Cindy used to keep a daily journal in HTML on our site, and that got very popular, and she did it for years. There's hundreds and hundreds of entries, if not thousands. But she got bored with it, so we went to Twitter. But we don't quite know what direction we're going to take with it, but it's been real successful, and we're going to stick with it.
Do you all have a Facebook page, too?
I have a Facebook page under my name, Tim Travis, and I just started, I guess you call it a group page or a fan page for our downtheroad.org.
Is it under downtheroad.org?
I think so. And Facebook is another thing we've only been doing since Yuma, so I'm definitely no Facebook expert. The okay. fan page is I only made a few days ago. And I think if you looked up downtheroad.org or bicycle touring, you would find it.
Okay.
How have you connected to the internet over time? Has gotten easier?
Definitely it's gotten easier. In the beginning, you know, internet cafes in 2002 in Mexico had Windows 3.5 and connecting to Windows NT machines, and we had a big clunky laptop with us, and I had to learn all the network protocols and all that in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And there was no such thing as Wi-Fi, at least not that I ever ran across, you know. And then we started seeing Wi-Fi after about 3 years on the trip, and we finally got another computer that had Wi-Fi. Now in the States, especially in the United States, it's very easy to pick up Wi-Fi just off of someone's house or the public library or people we stay with. It's really not a problem now, but in the beginning it was quite a challenge to connect to the internet with our own laptop.
Is that the way you pick up your connection now, just through libraries and stuff, or do you use a cellular internet connection?
Yeah, we looked at the cellular things, and boy, we'd love that, but we can't afford the monthly bill associated with that. And
yeah,
having internet is not enough. We also need a plug and a place to sit down inside out of the sun, because you can't use a computer out in the sun. So we thought about a cellular card, but that doesn't get us electricity and a nice place inside. So coffee shops and libraries and things like that offer all that.
Tell us a little bit about how this is affected your marriage. I mean, what's it like to be together really every day? And I'm sure there's sometimes decisions that are tough that, Tim, you want to do one thing and Cindy another. I mean, how do you make those decisions? And as a whole, has this experience brought you closer together?
I can say the experience has brought us a lot closer together. On the bike tour, as we tour, we've divided up our chores into my chores and Tim's chores, and it's actually easier for us on the road because we know what we need to do. And when we first left, we traveled in countries we weren't sure how good the security was. Central America and South America certainly had it's a little more dangerous places. So having Tim watching over me all the time was really nice. And so, you know, we stuck together side by side. And when you're together that much, you learn to talk things out. When things come up, you have the time to talk. We're lucky that we like to do the same things. And if Tim doesn't want to do something I want to do, we kind of split off and do our own thing. And so in the long run, it's strengthened our relationship.
Well, tell us about the chores, Cindy. What have you split up like on a typical day, getting ready to go biking and during the day and then settling down for the night?
Well, as we usually pack up our tent, pack up our clothes and get on the road. And Tim is quite a bit taller and bigger with his load. And I always draft. So I'm drafting behind him. And what ends up happening is when we get to the new place, I end up doing the cooking, and Tim ends up doing the washing of the dishes, that kind of thing. So we divide it up.
We learned early on that if we both go in the grocery store, you just fight about what you buy. So I watch the bikes, and she goes grocery shopping. She's in charge of our health and medical issues, and that's why she answered those questions. If there's a flat tire on the road, I'm in charge of all the mechanics. So before we leave, I don't have to worry about how much aspirin or antibacterial cream we have with us, and she doesn't have to worry about how many inner tubes that, you know, one's my responsibility and the other's hers. And it goes on and on down the line. She does the journal, I do the photo journal, and so forth and so on. That way we're not doing this by committee as far as the little choices and the little bits of work we have to do every day. We separate some things.
I do want to add that above at the top of the list, we have what we call our balanced budget agreement, which is probably where a lot of couples get into arguments is with finances. And so we laid out our finances early on and said, okay, if we spend this much a day, we will be able to travel this long. If we spend more than that, it's just going to shorten it. And it took me a little while to go, oh, you know, an expensive dinner isn't worth it to me. So we're both on the same page on how much money we spend. And we pull out how much we're going to have for the week, and that's what we spend.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about some times that you said that you split up because Cindy wants to go one way and Tim another. Are you talking like when you're in a town and you want to go exploring one place or another?
Yeah, I would say in the cities, like in Bangkok, Tim will stay in the hotel and work on the webpage, and I'll run around, buy groceries, look to see what's around, and maybe pick out some sites to see, and then come back and get Tim, kind of thing.
Got you.
I spend a lot of time writing on the computer, so it's kind of good when she's out doing that. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned security before. I understand you had a bit of excitement in Western Kansas. You were hit by a bottle, Tim?
Yeah, it was. This has happened to other places, so I can't say it's the strangest thing, but it was a strange thing. We're riding along on a pretty quiet road on the Venture Cycling Trail near, was it Alexandria, Kansas?
Yes.
And we hear a truck, some sort of 8-cylinder truck behind us, gun it, and start speeding up. To pass us, but there's no one else around. And then the next thing I know is something really big and heavy hit me in the back of the head. It sped my bike up about 5 or 6 miles an hour. And what had happened is they threw a loaded Gatorade bottle full of water at me and hit me in the back of the head, but I had my helmet on. Cindy was behind me. She's drafting off of me, and she can tell you what she saw.
Well, I saw the truck come up, an arm come out the window, and a bottle go flying, and it actually came over the top of me and hit Tim in the head. But they were pretty close. It happened so fast that I didn't have enough time to get a license plate completely.
Wow, that's scary.
I don't hold that accountable to Kansas and the good people of Kansas. I don't think that's unique to Kansas. We've had things thrown at us. In Canada, someone threw a lighter out of a bus window in Vietnam, Australia, and New Zealand. If you do this long enough, travel on a bike long enough, sooner or later, the odds catch up with you, and somebody crazy is going to do something crazy around you, like throw a bottle out the window. So I don't want the people of Kansas to think that I think that's a reflection on them. It's not. It's just sort of a reflection on humans.
Is it more so in the U.S. that you've had problems?
Well, I hate to say this, but we get yelled at a lot more here. Yeah. We've only had one thing thrown at us since we're here, but we definitely get a lot more aggression here. And I hate to think that about my own country. And I love the United States, of course, but it has happened more here in our experience.
Yeah, Randy and I have covered a lot of advocacy efforts and there's a number of states that have tried to, you know, have passed or are looking to pass laws to prevent this type of harassment of cyclists and more of an education on how much room to give cyclists to, you know, on the road, you know, the 3-foot rule. So it's a problem for all cyclists.
Yeah, just riding around Omaha here, we got yelled names while we're here just the other day.
Well.
But I'd like to add that 99.9% of the drivers go around us, and they give us that three feet, which is comforting. And through the thousands of miles I've ridden, the one thing I've noticed is if there's room for a cyclist and the car, then the cars really don't get as irritated, the drivers in the car, as long as there's room for both. It's on the narrow roads that things really get conflicted.
And just so we don't sound so negative, we really do believe that humans are mostly good. And like she said, most people go way around us. They're just not as memorable as the few that are angry or mean to us. But we still believe we have trust in the human race because they're driving behind us all the time. And if we didn't trust them, then we wouldn't be out on the road every day like we are.
When you pick your routes, do you try to look at that as far as especially coming across, you know, Kansas, let's say, and do you find roads that are less traveled?
Well, across Kansas, we were on the Adventure Cycling Trans Am Trail, so that was kind of picked for us, and it's a wonderful trail and a good experience to do the Trans Am. Other places, we do try to pick the quietest road we can. We're not in any kind of hurry, so we can zigzag all over the place. Mm-hmm. If it means a quieter road, we'll go 200 miles out of our way. But like I said, there's a trail across the U.S.
And in other areas, other cities we've been in, like Bangkok we've ridden into, and other big cities, we try to pick times like Sundays when the traffic isn't as heavy, or go outside of rush hour so there's not as much traffic.
There have been places we rode into Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, and Cindy said, there's no way I want to ride a bike out of this town, so we took a bus out. And we took a commuter train in and out of Sydney and in and out of Melbourne, and we avoided as much as we can.
I see.
What's it like to be bike touring in the U.S. again after you spent so much time in the rest of the world?
Well, it's very interesting for two things. We were gone away from the U.S. abroad for 6 years, so when we came back, we noticed the differences. And then it's also a nice homecoming because in the U.S., we don't have all this cultural confusion. We understand everybody and everything that's going around us. We grew up here. We know what people are thinking and doing, and we understand all the little innuendos and jokes and things like that. So it's different that way because it's our culture, and we understand our people.
And it's also easier. It's in a lot of ways very relaxing. The food we have here I'm used to. Americans are very friendly, and I really love that about America. I can go up and talk to anybody, and they'll talk back to me and not really be offended or be reserved. Other cultures are not as friendly.
And there's some nuts and bolts things that I can call my mom without being 12 time zones away, so it's a lot easier to call home. We don't need a visa here or any kind of special permission to travel here, so we can be here as long as we want. And we don't have to convert money. A U.S. dollar is worth a U.S. dollar, so it's a lot easier on many fronts.
Mm-hmm. You said you noticed some big differences when you came back. What jumped out at you?
Well, we got to realize we left shortly after 9/11, and we came back during the election, and that probably has something to do with it. But people here seem more polarized than they used to as far as politics and other issues. And there's a lot of anger from the left, from the right, kind of at each other. And we're kind of neutral. We're kind of observers, and it confuses us, all this polarization that we see in the country now.
Give us a brief rundown on your equipment, your bikes, your panniers, and your other gear.
Okay, equipment. Again, I'm in charge of security and equipment, so you get me again. We have sponsors that supply some of our gear, and we use Ortley panniers, so we have four panniers. And we have touring bikes with 26-inch wheels, and we have a stove and pots and pans and all the standard touring gear. I can't think of what else. We spend so much time with this stuff, I can't even think of what we have.
What kind of bikes are you riding?
At the moment, we have it was a sponsored deal that came and went, but they're Koga Miata bikes, a European company.
Steel frame?
These are aluminum bikes that we've had for the last 5 years. I have a custom-made bike back at my brother's house that I may switch back to when we get back there that really fits me like a glove. And Cindy may or may not switch her whole bike. She may keep this one. You never know.
You are resting now in Omaha, Nebraska after coming across Kansas, and you're going to be participating in Ragbri a week from today, July 19th, starting in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Will you be doing all of Ragbri, or are you just riding along for part of the time?
We are doing most of RAGBRAI. Tim has a speaking engagement in Ottumwa. That, I think, is Thursday the 23rd at 7 p.m., and we won't be riding that day. We'll be driving the bus. We're with a team, and so we don't have our exact schedule yet for when we're driving, but we'll definitely be driving that day and riding whatever day other days we can.
I have to say we've been invited by Team Roadshow to travel with them, and they have a bus, and we'll volunteer to drive it some, and we'll ride some.
And that's not, and then they will also, you don't have to carry all your equipment then either, right?
Right, and we have a lot of books with us that we're going to be selling at the Ottumwa Civic Center when I do my talk. So there's no way we carry all those books and all of our stuff. So we're glad they contacted us with the bus.
Great. Well, tell us about some of the interesting people you've met on your journey. Can you tell us about a couple of them and what about them was so unique?
One of my favorite people we've met is a guy named David, and he's Tamil Indian. He's from Malaysia. And we met him in Cambodia, and he invited us to his house when we got to Malaysia. A year and a half later, we arrive at his house. And David's a unique guy. He was an electrician in Malaysia. And because he was, he speaks four languages. He speaks Tamil, English, Hakka Chinese, and Malay, the local dialect. And he just loves culture and foreigners. And we ended up staying with him, and he took us to Chinese operas. We went to an Indian firewalking ceremony, an Indian wedding, and he exposed us to so many things. And at the same time, it was important for him, he felt, to expose the people of Malaysia to us, because he thought foreigners should, you know, everyone should meet each other. And I really felt he was a real gem, very good at just introducing everyone. And I learned so much from him.
And Lucho D'Angelo in Peru runs a Casa de Ciclista, or a cyclist house, and it's kind of an area of Peru where all the traveling cyclists kind of get funneled through this one town. So he started sort of a hostel for people, and it's a very international place. You go in, and there's people from all over the world who are traveling through South America who are staying with him for a week or so. And he is a bike nut and loves European road racing and has, you know, posters of European racing in five different languages. And, you know, Lucho is just a super charisma, super great guy. And I haven't seen him in years, but I'm definitely making plans to go back to see him.
I imagine you guys spend most of your time just kind of riding alone together. But on RAGBRAI, you're going to be with 10, 12, 15,000 other people. That's going to be strange, isn't it?
Very, yes. It's not only we in a country that speaks English like we do, we're going to be surrounded by people, and many of them, I would assume, know us from our website and have received our email newsletters and whatnot. And just to see all the people that we've known in the internet world or the virtual world, to see them face to face will be something. But we're not used to conversing with so many people. So it's going to be a bit tiring for us, very fun and exciting, but it's going to be we're going to be a fish out of water at such a thing.
I'm really looking forward to it, to be with like people who love to bike and go from town to town. It's just going to be a different experience, and that's going to be really cool.
Do you ever get the opportunity to ride with other people before around the world?
Every now and then we'll travel with other people, but I can probably count on one hand how many times somebody's been going our way at our speed and whatnot. Usually that occurs in a country or area where it's a bit dodgy or dangerous, and it's kind of good to buddy up. So you get the more people, the safer. We did that in Peru with a German man named Fritz, and we did it again with an English fellow, Andy, in Laos and later in Thailand. And I'm sure I'm missing a lot of good people we've rode with.
A Canadian named Tony in Argentina, and I don't think we did, in Argentina.
In Bolivia.
Did you run into them on the road, or were some of them planned that someone said, hey, I'm going to be somewhere, I'd like to ride with you, or did you just run into them?
Well, we've learned not to plan very far ahead in this business. So yeah. Nothing was very pre-planned. It was people we bumped into on the road, and they happened to be going our way, and it was, you know, they went about our speed, and it's safer to travel together. And, you know, you ride by cycle tourists are very independent. So the unwritten rule is you ride together until it doesn't work out for whatever reason, and then you go your separate ways. And we're all, you know, it all works out.
Right.
Did you run into many people coming or going on the Trans-America Trail?
Oh, every day.
Yeah, we camped. It was kind of fun on the Trans-American because, well, we met people going in the opposite direction. And we would camp with different cyclists every night, then ride to the next place and camp with different cyclists again. It was a lot of fun. And the same with the West Coast, except most of us were all going in the same direction on the West Coast.
You have been in so many areas of the world and seen many parts of the human experience, I'm sure, from extreme poverty to very great wealth. Which part did you find most troubling and which one most promising for us to, as humans on planet Earth here?
I would say for me, the most troubling was Guatemala, and it's so close to here. And I had never seen poverty at that level where they just make their own clothes. And if you ate in a restaurant and we went to pay for our meal and they didn't have change, and it took a half hour to find change for what would be the equivalent of a $5 meal, and I gave them a $10 bill. It was just unbelievable how little money people had. And I didn't realize that people lived at that level. It was quite heart-wrenching to see. And I still often think of those people in Guatemala. And the same with Bolivia is another area that people were extremely poor, and Cambodia. The thing in Cambodia, I'll switch to there, because Cambodia had gone through so much with Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge and genocide. I was really worried about going into there. And when we got there, people were very poor, but the kids were very excited to see people, and people were very happy and genuinely happy to be with each other. And they really impressed me on their resilience and their desire to have a better life, and they were looking forward and not back.
For me, the troubling thing I noticed, and I know Cindy did too, was people who live under political oppression. And I love the Chinese, and I love the Chinese people and food, and they're really sweet, but I would not want to live under that government. It is a super oppressive government. Vietnam was to a lesser extent, but still pretty oppressive. And we've seen one-party systems and dictators and all this, and you really feel for these people because we get to see it and leave, and they're stuck with it for however long it's going to be there. But seeing people politically oppressed and all their human rights taken away through their government is really disheartening.
How did that become apparent to you? I mean, through talking or just seeing them? I mean, what would be an example?
Well, if I stick with the communist countries, Vietnam and China and Laos, it started in Vietnam when there's a guy in the internet cafe who can read English, and his job is to look over your shoulder and read what you're writing in your email or whatnot, read what you're doing on the internet, and there's no qualms about it. He's going to look over your shoulder, and he's going to read it, and there's nothing you can do about it. But then we moved to China, where we got arrested for taking pictures, and it's a long story. It's a good story. We thought they were farmers, so we pulled over, and we took their pictures of what we thought were indigenous farmers. We were only in the country for 10 days out of a 9-month trip. So we're pretty green in China. And we really did not know they were prisoners, but it turns out they were. And that's illegal in China, to take pictures of uniformed people or prisoners or a whole list of other things you can't take pictures of. And it was quite an ordeal. It's all written up on our website.
Well, the other things we saw in China real briefly is we were pulled out of hotel room. You know, we couldn't stay in hotels because they weren't allowed to take foreigners. We did stay in a hotel in Yunnan province. And after we left, we basically saw the military and secret police go running in to talk to these people. And I felt really bad. I did not know what kind of trouble they were going to get into for letting foreigners stay in their hotel.
They have to have a license for letting people stay in. There are other times we'd stop in little villages, and we, you know, inevitably you draw a big crowd because they maybe have never seen foreigners. I haven't seen foreigners very often. And they, 300 people or so would gather around us just to watch and listen to us speak English. But then a cop would show up and just start beating them with a billy club or something. And it just breaks your heart to see things like that.
Wow.
And we just kept moving. We tried to disperse the crowd because, you know, I felt responsible for them getting hit.
Tell us about how about promising things that you saw on the trip.
Well, every day. We always say that the bad things really stick with you because they're very few but memorable. But the good things are, there's just hundreds of good things we see every day. And the human beings have a lot of hope, and they really are tenacious and can survive whatever situations they're thrown into. And we've seen families start a little business making wooden furniture and that prosper. Or we've seen countries move away from oppressive governments, like Chile was having a real good, prosperous time because they moved away from a dark period and into a brighter period for them. And
For me, places, we landed in Argentina, and it's a unique country, and they have a real love of life. When they sit down and eat, they have a tablecloth. When you drink something, it's out of a glass. And they really put a lot of energy and their time into the quality of life. And I learned that the quality of life isn't always measured monetarily, but they really spent a lot of time with their family. And so the Argentinians kind of taught me to really slow down, take your time in your meals, and enjoy the people that you're with.
That's a wonderful lessons. I'm just saying, you know, you've seen so much of different people and different lands. It's just a wonderful experience that you've had and continue to have.
Well, we do feel very fortunate we've been able to do this.
Was there anything else that you'd like to tell our listeners on the podcast?
I don't know. You know, we're often asked what we've learned, and it's very complicated to say. You do this for so many years, and then yet you can't put it in words. A lot of people, some of the poorest people we've met have been some of the happiest, and that's hard to figure out why. And some of the wealthiest people throw bottles out of windows at people riding down the road, and that's hard to wrap your head around. Some people have learned to be content with what they have and not wish for more, and I think that's a big secret to life, is to be content with what you have and not wish for things that you cannot have. You can wish for things that are obtainable, and I think people do, in these poorer countries, but they don't wish they had things that they're just never going to have, because that yearning for something is a wanting is a disease, and people who just want and want and want will never be happy. And having something will never satisfy wanting, because as soon as you have something you want, the want continues, and now you just want a new thing and another thing and a bigger thing, and it goes on and on. And the simple people and the poor people of this world have just learned to limit their want to what they can have.
That's very well said, because I see that with a lot of people that have gained a lot of wealth, and then they just keep buying things, but they're never really happy. It's just they just, you know, keep purchasing and buying or selling and buying. And you all really had to do that in listening to your book to really downsize as far as what you needed and wanted, because that's all on your bike. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that was, I'd say it might have been a little bit harder for me than Tim. So we downsized. We kind of started slowly. And now I kind of look at things and say, do I want this or do I need this? And then I think, oh, I have to carry it. So I really don't really want so much stuff anymore. After traveling and seeing all the tourist things, the memories and the photos are enough for me. But I have to admit, in the beginning, it was a little hard not to have my full wardrobe and 10 pairs of shoes And but I've gotten used to it, and I can say that the trip for me has been a gift of time. We have time to talk to people. We have time to work through our issues. We have time to figure out what to do next, rather than making decisions or doing things so fast that you say, oh, maybe I should have done that differently. I kind of feel like I have more time to experience life. It's simpler.
How do you figure out what to do next? How much planning goes into choosing a destination?
Well, as far as the next place we'll fly to, that tends to be my I take the lead on that, and of course we talk about it together. Right now it has to do with the economy. Our economy's down, everyone's sales are down, our book sales are down, and not as much as money's coming in. So we're looking at the countries or continents that we have left and deciding which ones do we want to see that we can afford, maybe which ones are the cheaper. So what's on our list now for next would be either India and neighbors, and that'd be about 3 years, or Eastern Europe and Africa, and that'd be about 3 years. And India is certainly cheaper, in Nepal, Bangladesh, Pakistan. Also, it has to do with visa availability. If they ever dropped the ban on Americans going to Cuba, we would probably change our plans quickly and go to Cuba. I know a lot of Americans go, but we have a fairly public life, and we really can't go illegally to Cuba. If we could get a visa for Iran, we would plan some trip around that, because we'd really like to see and meet the people of Iran.
How much detail do you plan the trips? How far out do you plan it? Just plan a rough route and then figure it out as you go? Or
We kind of plan a rough route around the weather, and then I kind of take over on the daily details. And it, like in the United States, it's been so easy because we want to be on the adventure cycling route. So we just say, okay, which route do we go to next? And after we leave here, we'll be on an adventure cycling route, which makes it easier for that day-to-day planning, which is my arena. When we were overseas and we didn't know where we were going, we kind of based it on a food availability, water availability. It just depended on our, you know, if we had everything we needed to travel that day.
I pick the month and the state or region or small country. Cindy picks the roads. She does all the research on what roads we take and whatnot. And I do the bigger plan of, well, let's see, it's December, so Guatemala has good weather then. And then in January, we'll start moving south. But it starts getting hot, so then we'll go to the Andes, for example. Or in China, we spent spring in the south, summer in the north, and fall coming back down where it was warmer. So we're always looking at the weather and things like that for the big plan.
Do you use GPS for traveling or just paper maps?
Just paper maps so far. We've had our eye on GPS. We'd love to buy a GPS, but we've never had the money for a GPS. And then, say, as soon as we fly to India, I don't think the maps are available and stuff, so it wouldn't be a great investment. If we had one now, we'd use it every day, no doubt. But as soon as you go overseas, I don't think the maps are as detailed, and maybe it's not as usable.
Tim and Cindy, we'd love to talk to you for hours more, and I'm sure we could, but we have to finish up, and thank you again. It really has been an honor to have you on our show and spend some time with you, and the very best of luck as you continue your journey forward.
Well, we want to thank you and all the wonderful people of Kansas for allowing us to visit and travel and enjoy ourselves there. We've met a lot of hospitable people and had a good time in the big and small places of Kansas, and it's a place that we'll always remember.
Yeah, Kansas has awesome tailwinds.
And we'll be following your Twitters and website too, so we'll post some updates.
All right, nice talking to you guys.
Yeah, nice meeting you guys.
We appreciate you downloading Episode 7 of the Kansas Cyclist Podcast, and do hope that you will subscribe so that you will not miss out on future episodes. We have a lot of interesting news, information, bicycle safety tips, and interviews that we have planned for future episodes, so please come back. Also, take the time and leave your feedback, and or if you would like to become a sponsor, please write or send your audio file to podcast@kansascyclist.com. Remember, there are show notes for each podcast on the website, which includes links to all the news, rides, trails, bicycle, safety tips, and interviews that have been discussed on each podcast. We would also like to thank Mark Fransky for allowing us to use his song called Brush Creek Crossing as our theme music. Take care and cycle safe.